Our first speaker is Professor Brenna Argall. She is the June and Donald Brewer Jr. Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at Northwestern University, as well as Assistant Professor and Research Scientist at the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at the Rehabilitation Institute in Chicago. She has a PhD and undergraduate in mathematics and robotics from Carnegie Mellon University. Her research interests lie at the intersection of robotics, machine learning, and rehabilitation. And she is going to be talking with us this morning with the title of Turning Assistive Machines into Assisting Robots. So, Professor Argall.
Okay, so I'm going to start out talking a little bit about potential intersections between robotics and rehabilitation. So in particular, I've taken all of these images from RIC's website. So RIC is the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago, which is actually a hospital right down in Streeterville. And at RIC, we are looking to address impairments in humans that deal with their sensory system, their cognitive system, and also their motor system, really particularly their motor system. Now, if we look at robots and the progression of robots sort of throughout the ages since they started showing up in factories in like the 1960s to some domains that we're starting to see them in the home today, so we've got a cleaning robot that's sort of like a toy, and we've got toy robots, we've got robots that are now being used in medical facilities or medical capacities, to domains where we would like to see robots eventually as sort of partners and actual teammates with robots and assisting, or sorry, with humans and assisting humans and physically touching them. So the robots at the top of this image, they are not sensing their external environment. They're not safe to be right next to humans. So if all the robots that actually are involved in factory manufacturing, they're kept behind cages, and opening the cage door shuts down the robot. So these are not robots that would be applicable for the domains down there. What has really facilitated this transition from robots that have to be in cages to robots that can be in the home and where we would like them to be actually assisting humans is robot autonomy. So these are videos from RoboCup, which is a great example domain of robot autonomy. So what happens in RoboCup is that teams start their code. They can't touch it once it's started. So if your code crashes, you just have to sit there for 15 minutes while the other team kind of obliterates you. And what these robots are doing is they're actually actively perceiving the world. So in the top domain, there's actually a top-mounted camera looking down. You'll notice that there's stickers on top of all the robots. And that's actually, these sticker codes are unique. And so you can track where your teammates are. You can track where the other team is. You can track where the ball is and where the goals are, and then you make strategic decisions based on this in order to play soccer. In the bottom domain, all the sensing is actually on board. There's a camera in the IBO's nose, and then they communicate with their teammates through wireless. So in particular, these domains actually are very robust. So this is these videos are actually about 8 years old at this point. And so you can see how robust or how able these autonomous systems were even 8 years ago. Now, why this is good news for rehabilitation is that in order to have that autonomy, robotics has had to come up with synthetic ways to sense the world, to reason about it, and then to take action within it. And it represents a real opportunity that we can leverage these advantages to help people who have impairments in their sensory, cognitive, or motor systems. So in particular, in the world right now, we already have a lot of assistive machines. So by far the most ubiquitous is the powered wheelchair. We also see examples of prosthetics. We see examples of exoskeletons, and these so far are being used mainly for therapy purposes, but we would like eventually for them to actually be mobility devices. And in the lower left-hand corner, we see an example of a robotic arm that actually is a commercial product that's meant to be mounted to a powered wheelchair. Now, one of the challenges that we have as we move from the machines that are, as these machines become more sophisticated and complex, is that they also become more complex to control. So a powered wheelchair is a two-dimensional control problem. You have speed and heading, and so that's very easily handled by a two-axis joystick that deflects like this and deflects like this. A robotic arm, is actually nominally a six-dimensional control problem. So you have the position of the end effector in three dimensions and also the orientation in three dimensions. And how to actually come up with interfaces that will actually control all of those dimensions at once is a real challenge. That's something that currently the manufacturer of this arm basically divides up the control space into what's called modes, and you have to push a button on the joystick to transition between controlling in position and controlling in orientation. Now, that's certainly possible to do, but it can be a little bit cumbersome, and that's also assuming you can operate that kind of joystick, which by definition, a lot of people who would benefit from the help of a robotic arm can't do that. So if you are now limited to, for example, to a sip and puff. I don't know if people have ever seen people trying to drive a powered wheelchair with a straw-based interface. This is now issuing only one-dimensional signal at a time, and it's discrete. So if you blow faster or blow harder, you don't go faster. So this makes it much more challenging even to control a powered wheelchair, much less these more complex devices. So the idea is that we would like to take advances in robotics automation and autonomy and apply that to help control these more complex devices, where the human is still in the loop, but some of the control burden is offloaded from them. So how do you turn an assistive machine into an assistive robot? So you start out with the machine. You have to add sensors so that it's able to detect its external environment, because it's going to need to make decisions about what to do dynamically as the environment around it changes. We add computing and artificial intelligence, and then our assistive machine has become an assistive robot. So in my lab, we are building a smart wheelchair, and two of the things that we are prioritizing are customization and low cost. The reason why we want to customize to the user is because everyone is different in their personal preferences and in their physical abilities. And then the reason why we want to prioritize low cost is that we're not expecting this is actually going to be covered by insurance anytime soon. So when a person gets outfit for a powered wheelchair, a therapist fills out a stack of papers this thick justifying each design decision, each seat cushion, each aspect of the driving interface in order to get insurance to pay for it. Now, our dream is that eventually what you actually need in terms of your autonomy needs will actually be a part of this packet, but that is going to require very extensive user studies that can see cost-benefit analysis and all of these sorts of things, and so we're not expecting that that's going to happen anytime soon. So one of the ways that we're accomplishing customization is through having a modular software architecture. So here are example assistance modules that might be running on our powered wheelchair, and the idea is that a user can opt into or out of any number of these. Each of these also is going to be sharing control with the human. So we're expecting we're going to be getting control signals from the human, and we want to share control with them. And this is actually a very delicate thing, because you never want to take control away from the human when they don't want you to. You also can't give it back to them when they're not expecting it. So getting this right is important. And that's why we parameterize it. So we parameterize it so we can actually customize it to each person. And what we're going to be doing next is actually adapting these things online in response to feedback that we get from the human and from the environment. And that ties back actually into, I have a background in robot machine learning that I'm not really talking about in this talk. One of the ways that we're making the system low cost is by making the hardware modular. So on the left, we expect that someone would come with their own powered wheelchair and control interface, and this would have been covered by insurance. And on the right, we strap on our own computing and intelligence, and then also these sort of sensor modules, where the addition of each new module does add additional cost, but it also might add additional robustness or unlock additional control behaviors. Now, Some of the software capabilities that's on this robot. One thing that we need to do is be able to perceive goals. And this is because we don't want the user to have to sit there and explicitly tell us each time they want to do something. That would be cumbersome, and it kind of gets away from the goal of making the control problem easier. So here on the left, we have an example of detecting doorways autonomously, and on the right, we have an example of detecting safe docking locations at like tables or desks autonomously. These are both geometrical approaches. They're using just the 3D information from an RGBD sensor. So one Microsoft Kinect is providing all of this data, and we're not using the image data. And the idea is that once you have these goal locations, you can feed it to an autonomous path planner that has sensed where there are obstacles in the world and can plan a safe path to one of these goal locations. So once we actually have these goals, we need to figure out how we want to share control with the human, as I mentioned earlier. So on the right-hand side, you'll see an example. If you watch my thumb, I'm teleoperating the robot, and I'm trying to drive the robot straight into the chair. And what it's reasoning about is It's actually forward projecting my control command, and it's setting that as a small temporary sub-goal, and it's seeing whether or not that sub-goal lies in an obstacle. If it does, we have a path planner that we basically project it out a little bit further. We have a path planner plan a safe path, and then we basically iteratively step the human's control signal over towards the safe control signal of the path planner. So what this looks like is that we have this blending parameter alpha, like I showed a little bit earlier, and alpha equals 0 means all of the control is with the robot, and alpha equals 1 means all the control is with the human. You can see as we're approaching the obstacle in a way that's going to have us collide with them, control is sort of iteratively shifted away. And here we're kind of balancing the fact that you'll see that we only have 6 values that alpha can take on, and that's kind of a balance between computational efficiency, but also not just wrenching control from the human, doing it in somewhat of an iterative process. On the left-hand side here, if you watch my thumb, you'll see that I'm teleoperating the robot towards 2 goals. These are both autonomously identified by our perception algorithm. And when I stop, it's unclear which door I wanted to go through. And so the robot does not take over control. But when I stop the second time, it now is more clear. I've given more control signals that make that more better indicate which goal I wanted. And this is also important, that we need to actually infer what is the user's goal if we have a bunch of different goals. And we do this from a combination of our goal perception confidence and also the control signals that we're getting from the human. Now, another challenge within assistive domains that I kind of I spoke to earlier is, how do we control these more complex and higher dimensional systems? And in particular, how do we do it with these limited control interfaces that only give us a one-dimensional control signal? And here is an example of a robotic arm that's in my lab, the Mika robotic arm. And this is a six-dimensional robot with also a two-fingered gripper at the end. So one of the approaches that we're taking is something called assistive teleoperation. And the idea is that even if you have these low-dimensional control signals, if you have a perception algorithm that can see where there are objects in the scene that you might want to interact with, you can take these low-dimensional signals as cues. You can imagine, even if I only had a 1D control signal that was going left to right like this, you would be able to tell which of these two bottles I wanted to pick up, right? You don't need the full six-dimensional signal to get ideas about that. And so the idea is that once the robot is more and more confident about which goal, we transfer more and more control to the robot, so that by the time you get to the point where you're actually physically interacting with the robot and you need to do more sophisticated manipulation, it can be 100% autonomous if the human wants that. Another area that we're looking into is coming up with different sorts of interfaces. This is a collaboration with Sandro Musovaldi at RIC, and he's developed that vest on the right, which is something called the body-machine interface. It has accelerometers on it, and the general idea is that you can kind of turn the body into a joystick, and that this can be used with even with patients with high spinal cord injury. So lots of times, even patients that are essentially quadriplegics have a little bit of residual motion left in their shoulders. And the idea is that if the control interface for these assistive machines encourages them to move like that, actually operating the assistive machine also becomes a form of rehabilitation therapy. And so the idea is that we can have the robot taking over a portion of the control as the person is learning to issue these higher dimensional control signals, and then iteratively scale back the help that we're giving until the user can issue the full six-dimensional signal themselves. We're actually not even sure that's possible. So far, Sandra's group has only done a 2D control signal, but we're certainly interested in looking into it. And what's kind of neat about this is that we're actually using now robot machine learning to help elicit human motor learning, and that's a concept that we're really excited about. This is a video that was just a first proof of concept. What the user is controlling here, the user is issuing a 2D control signal, and one dimension is controlling the speed of these predefined trajectories that the robot is executing, and then also the transition between these trajectories. So we've defined this control task as reaching for an object, grabbing it, carrying it towards a second object, and then pouring it. And so there's 4 different iterative or piecewise trajectories within that. And through this interface, he's signaling there. He just signaled how to toggle it. Now, you notice his movement was really big because he is able-bodied. But that's actually what we want. We don't want this to only require low-profile movements, because we want to encourage the person to move as much as they can within the residual motion that they have left to them. So in summary, there's a lot of assistive machines in the world, and they are really crucial for people regaining independence in their lives. But there are people for whom they are inaccessible, or they don't get used to their full utility because it's a challenge to control them. And the idea is that we would like to leverage robotics automation to help make that more possible. And with that, I'd like to thank my the students in my lab, who, of course, actually are the ones who end up doing most of the work. Thanks. Should I take it out?
Yeah. I think they're going to come up and swap it out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Take questions.
So.
Yes, we're going to swap out a computer here, I believe. And so I would like to open up the panel here. If any follow-up questions, I see David's ready to go.
I really like your example of sliding autonomy. I think it really is exciting.
Yeah.
But the question that it begs, in a way, is how do you adjust it?
Yes.
So, for example, you have this great thing where you're avoiding the thing, but if there's an error, suppose it bumps into it anyway.
Yeah.
Then you want to obviously move it to virtually 100% human control.
Yeah. So we basically, we guarantee that it's always going to, so part of why it's iterative is because it's a forward projection. And so, you know, when the collision isn't so imminent, we don't need to fully follow the safe path yet because we'll be able to get over to the safe path. So we basically guarantee that the action that's actually going to be sent to the robot will not actually execute a collision. But we can actually, it's just that in sort of the lead up to that, we do it iteratively, so we're not just wrenching control. But, you know, our number one concern, of course, is safety. We also can sort of consider the fact that it's not that the robot hit the object. The human actually hit the object, right, which they probably would have done anyway. So it's a little bit of a different safety concern than we traditionally have in robotics, I
right.
think, in that respect.
Your turn.
Thank you, Dr.
Surprise.
Okay, our second speaker in our panel on machines is Laura Frank. Laura is a senior software engineer at CenturyLink Laboratories. She has degrees from the University of Wisconsin and DePaul University, and her work interest is in the area of software virtualization, where new emphasis is being placed on containerization and the role that containers play in distributed software environments in terms of deployment. She is a core maintainer of the Panamax project, which is an open source tool that helps engineers manage their Docker containers. So please help me welcome Laura Frank, who will be talking about the future of distributed applications.
Thank you very much for the introduction and, of course, the invitation to speak. My name is Laura Frank, and as Professor Shacklett just said, I work for CenturyLink Laboratories or CenturyLink Labs. CenturyLink is a telecom company. It's similar to Time Warner Cable or Comcast, but I don't work on anything related to kind of subscribable services. We have a small research and development team comprised of 13 senior engineers, and we just work on open source software all day. So if you're unfamiliar as to what open source software is, it's basically software where the source code is distributed for free, with some kind of license that allows people to use it without cost and implement it in their own projects, kind of however they see fit. The social contract that comes with open source software is that if you decide to modify it or you change it in any way, that you contribute that change back so that other people can benefit from it. The idea of having a team solely kind of writing software for free and not making money off of it isn't new. It's not something brand new that CenturyLink is doing. In fact, companies like AT&T have done it, and I think it really represents kind of a more collaborative approach to engineering, one that I certainly appreciate. So I want to open up a conversation about distributed applications this morning, I guess, still morning. Distributed applications, I'm not talking about distribution in terms of how things come into your hands as a user and how you use them. I'm using the term distributed as a way to describe how the application is architected and kind of the composure of the application itself. And the reason we've kind of come to this point of distribution and application architecture, application engineering, is because software is constantly evolving. Just as humans change and our needs change, the software that we write often dictates the processes that we integrate into our lives. So as we change and our habits change, the software that we use every day needs to change as well. And in conjunction with that, the way that we design, deploy, and distribute software is also changing. So applications used to run on just one computer. This is kind of in recent memory for some of us and maybe not for others, but first we had one computer that kind of ran the whole show, and soon that wasn't sufficient. And now we have multiple computers, but it didn't take long for that to be insufficient as well. And pretty soon we moved into a model where we have virtual machines, so not actual physical computers, but a virtualization layer in a data center that's housing our application code. So this sort of begs the question of what's the next step? If we look to the past to kind of inform our future, we can see that one computer was not sufficient, many computers were not sufficient. Now we have this virtualization model inside of a data center, which are basically just giant, giant buildings, not meant for humans, but meant for machines instead. We have these virtual machines running in there, but it can kind of be a logical jump to figure out that if the two solutions before it weren't great, then we're probably going to run into a problem with our current model. And in fact, we're finding that this is fairly accurate. So it's safe to say that each pattern or each generation of this kind of distribution or the way that we design, package, and deploy our applications comes from the same problem set. Each iteration and each generation of our best practices have been in response to similar problems. And those problems can kind of be classified into three main categories. The first is cost. So the time to market is certainly cost. Human time is cost. And we found that with previous models for application distribution, distribution meaning delivering it, it just took too much time. And also things were very expensive monetarily. So the convergence of time and money just made it not very attractive. We can also point to some of these systems and see that they're very inefficient. So they don't utilize resources well. There's high operational overhead for various reasons, high consumption of resources. And most of this comes from the need for redundancy because we also want these apps to be highly available. So that means redundancy, but creating redundancy and having kind of insurance without having waste is a problem that is still being solved in different ways, some of them better than others. And we find the systems that we've used or the practices that we've used to also be inflexible. And this is due in part to the fact that it's sometimes hard to scale out. You can make your unit of computation kind of bigger, and you can allocate more memory to it, and you can make the hard drive bigger, but making it repeatable and making many of kind of the computational processes happen concurrently without waste is sometimes difficult. And also from a business standpoint, there are a lot of services that provide kind of cloud computing and other things that you might be familiar with, software as a service, infrastructure as a service. A lot of these businesses have vendor lock-in, so if you use their particular way of doing things, you can't just take your code and move it somewhere else. You'd have to reconfigure it. So you get kind of locked in and trapped into a certain workflow that something external is deciding for you. And this can lead to stalled or low innovation, which no one likes, especially in software, which has to kind of change very rapidly. So indeed, these problems also apply to virtual machines and data centers. So how do we solve it? And there's a very famous quote in computer science, which is one of my favorites, from a man named David Wheeler that says, "All problems in computer science can be solved by another level of indirection." The quote goes on to say, "except for the problem of too many layers of indirection." So we can think about indirection in the context of what I'm going to be talking about with virtualization is maybe another level of granularity or another level of componentization, so or layer of abstraction is also a good way to think about it if you're kind of unfamiliar with some computer science terms. So the solution to our problem of virtual machines in a data center is containerization. And containerization is just kind of the next step of granularity. We've already seen things go from one big monolithic application to smaller applications that are talking to each other to even smaller, and now they're getting smaller yet. So even as recent, the year 2000 wasn't that long ago, we tended to have these kind of big applications, and we described them as monolithic. They had sort of everything combined in them. So because they were kind of big and slow moving, kind of like a big boulder, they were sitting on big servers, they were kind of hard to change. And we realized that that model wasn't great, right? That's not great for innovation, that's not great for problem solving at the speed in which we need to solve them. So we split those up into kind of smaller components, and you can see the granularity get a little more fine-grained as we go from the year 2000 to today, where now we have these very loosely coupled services that function mostly independently from one another. Because they're functioning independently and have a very limited scope of responsibility, we can update them very quickly. And instead of being deployed on a very large server, as we saw kind of with the one big computer, we have many small servers. You can think about this kind of trend that in the year 2000, a non-technical example would be walking into a restaurant and having the same person seat you, take your order, cook your food, and wash your dishes. Of course, that doesn't scale well, and it feels kind of strange. We would expect that we would have different people do all of those same things. So that's kind of a non-technical way to represent the way that software architecture and software deployment patterns have been evolving as well. So, and it does stand to say, too, that the evolution in architecture, so breaking down how the software functions itself into small components, needs to be reflected in the infrastructure that we use to house and execute that code that we've written. So containerization is just another type of virtualization that kind of continues on this path, taking us from big monolithic, slow-moving, not very innovative software, pieces of software into smaller, rapidly changing, collaborative, very portable software systems. And the reason that containerization specifically is very, it's kind of very trendy right now. It's been in the news a lot because companies like Google, Twitter, Netflix, et cetera, they're using it because it does hit on these three pain points pretty well. In terms of cost, you can take your deployments, so actually pushing code to production for consumption, down from minutes to seconds and sometimes even hours to minutes. This leads to a faster time to market, so the time that you have an idea to the time it can be in front of somebody, potentially making money for you, is far less. You can also consolidate workloads pretty significantly. So there are some benchmarks by IBM, and they've estimated it's really anywhere between 2 and 10 times the amount of work. The same amount of work on the, I'm sorry, you can do the same, you can do 10 times the amount of work on the same piece of hardware. It tends to be probably more toward the 10 times and not so much the 2 times, depending on the engineering behind it, but it's pretty significant. And also very flexible. So these are very portable pieces of software, and you can replicate them very easily. And because they're so small and have such limited scope of responsibility, it's very easy to have redundancy without waste, which we saw was kind of an issue in earlier systems. And the reason that containerization, aside from all of these great kind of cost-benefit analysis benefits, is becoming very popular is because of a company called Docker. Docker is both a company and a project, so I work for CenturyLink Labs, but I work with the Docker project every day. And you might have seen this logo if you kind of have been reading the news lately. They just closed a round of funding and have a pretty high valuation. Their headquarters are in San Francisco. And Docker combines two things that make it easy to adopt for other engineers. So first is the Docker engine. This is the technical component of containerization. This is the actual runtime engine that's going to be executing your code for you. There's also a Docker hub, which is the community aspect. So sharing things, a place to find news, tips, blog posts, et cetera, to kind of help other people and be helped by other people while you are yourself containerizing your application. So the Docker mission is actually pretty straightforward. Build, ship, run, any application, anywhere. So if we think about granularity and reproducibility and portability, this is exactly what Docker is trying to do. So they're trying to take any application or any component of any application and have it be possible to distribute it and to run it anywhere, whether it's your local machine, if you're developing and testing, to anywhere in the cloud, or any kind of infrastructure. You can choose the infrastructure that fits your needs. I'm not going to go into the technical details of how containers function, but I will tell you that they are just self-contained execution environments. So it's kind of a way to fence off software processes on some piece of hardware. But instead of having other software control it, it's kind of locking in or hooking into existing components. So it's very lightweight because you don't need a lot of other stuff in order to make containers work. And because of this, they have very low overhead, and most companies are finding that when they adopt containerization into their own workflow, they are finding speed, savings, and innovation. And Docker has become very widely adopted very quickly. So this is a study by Enterprise technological research. They were doing some analysis on how quickly software vendors and other developers are adopting kind of new projects or new ways of doing things. And you can see that Docker is number one and kind of unprecedented early adoption. So it's becoming quite popular quite quickly, even in terms of very large companies. So there's many large companies that are using it, but they're using it because it helps them deploy code more quickly. So 1,500 times a week deploying code is a pretty astounding feat. Gilt Group ships their code 100 times a day. That's kind of similar to saying deploying. And BBC News, when they do their continuous integration job, so that's kind of the automated process of delivering code, they're running 60% faster. So you can imagine all of these small, repeatable things that go into software engineering, and if they're able to be done even in half the speed, so half the time, half the human time, half the engineering power sometimes, it can lead to a very significant economic benefit for the company. So we can think about better infrastructure and helping us solve problems in a new way. So similar to the way that a new road or a new train line might help you move more quickly from point A to point B, better infrastructure and technology can help us get problems from kind of the problem's inception to the solution much more quickly, to hopefully having that solution be in front of the people that it can help. From a business standpoint, businesses are benefiting from faster time to market, lower operating costs. Their employees are finding that their teams are being organized in different ways around containerization. So each piece of software has a very limited scope of responsibility. Therefore, the teams that produce that software also have a limited scope of responsibility. And that generally means more autonomy. So the organization of your software generally is reflected in the organization of your humans. And this leads to much more developer happiness, I would say, is a good qualitative a measure of this particular point. And then on the very end, the users benefit from highly available, high-performing applications for the kind of reasons that I outlined earlier in terms of utilization and redundancy. So as new problems arise, containerization and using containerization in our software can help us implement solutions much more quickly. And this is important because we can't predict problems, but we can probably bet now that containerization and improvements on infrastructure and technology will be part of the solution to whatever problems that we need. So thinking about the way that humans and technology intersect, containerization is a technical component, but it can help us solve human problems in a faster and more efficient way. So thank you very much.
1,500 builds a day, that's a lot more significant than the overnight builds that that I remember. Our next speaker is Professor David Bourne. He is principal systems scientist and founding member of the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon University, and is also affiliated with the Center for Integrated Manufacturing Decision Systems. He has an undergraduate degree from the University of Vermont and a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania. He is now focusing on how humans can most effectively participate in a robot-centric society without losing sight of what's important to our human experience. His conclusion is to focus robots on working with people. His talk today is titled "The Future of Making Things." So please help me welcome Professor David Bourne.
So manufacturing things is really important. I think it sounds really dull and dirty and like a nasty job to everybody, but just for one second, forget that. And imagine you're these guys sitting out in the tundra and you want to make stuff to trap animals. Well, there's a whole legacy for how to do that, a whole skill set for knowing how to make things. In fact, the artifacts that we make in our society carry us from generation to generation. So if you think carefully about it, all the things we do really strongly are predetermined by our predecessors. So when we walk around with this thing, this is built upon generation and generation, and yet this thing has changed the way we live, changed the way we think. The manufacturing has changed. But there's a big risk these days that we forget how to make things. And that's why manufacturing is so important. If we forget how to make things, in a way, we forget how to transmit our knowledge from generation to generation, because really it's the technology that holds us together over time. So these guys are doing something fundamentally interesting. Now, when we get into a world of 3D printing and robotics making things, then that's just another excuse to forget how to make things. So there's a big danger with this, that all of a sudden we're going to have robots making all our things. What are we going to do, sit home and watch soap operas? Really, this is the heart of the human experience, whether you do craft or whether you just put your computer together or whether your wife tells you to fix the plumbing at home. All of these things really define our experience of what it means to be human. So I'm interested in robots doing manufacturing because it's more efficient. There's various arguments for it. But I also want the human to participate in that experience, to really enjoy that experience. And that's what my work's about and what that means. So we have a robot that does welding. In fact, what we're going to do is make space frames for Hummers, military spec Hummer. It sounds kind of boring, but it's a big thing. Imagine if you could make your own vehicle, of any custom vehicle you wanted at your house. Just think how exciting that would be. So that's kind of what I'm talking about, the excitement of making things and participating in the process. And so I have a hypothesis that people and robots can do this much more efficiently than either alone. And so part of that is really thinking carefully about what people are good at and what robots are good at. And you know what? There's really hardly a person in this room, including one of my colleagues, that probably knows, wouldn't jump to the right answer. Actually, robots are really bad at a lot of stuff. For example, going back to this, if you want to manipulate this cell phone. This is really hard, manipulation of a task like this, and what I can do with speaking in front of you with my eyes closed, robots can't really do. So that's an example. Material manipulation, material handling, robots are really bad at. And yet, that's what most robotics companies say they can do, is material handling. So what can robots do anything? Well, yes, the answer is they can do some stuff. They're really good at positioning themselves in space. So if you told a robot to put a part at an XYZ roll theta yaw position, you know, at a certain orientation in space, it's amazing. It can go there instantly with 0.03 millimeters of accuracy. If I asked you, anyone in this room, to do that, you'd look at me and I bet you all could do it, but half a day would go by before you could do one. So there's huge disparity in skill level, and yet I can do this. So the question becomes, what should the robot do and what should the person do? But before we get there, I set up a competition between a human team making this space frame and a robot-human team. And again, the hypothesis is that the robot and human team can do better. So the human team is three experts with each 10 years of experience at Pratt & Miller. These guys make racing cars out of stock cars. So racing NASCAR. So they do this every day. Welding is what they live on. And so this is kind of a Paul Bunyan thing, right? So I've got three experts. They've got all their tools, all their fixtures, all their ways of working, which actually is a lot of money. So equivalent amount of money is having a robot and a student do this. So we have Michael Dawson Haggerty here, who's my master's student, and he's pretty good with his hands. So he took on the robot as his team member. And so they were going to compete head-to-head, trying to make this custom-made frame for a military-spec Hummer. So let's see what it looks like. So this is going to show what part of the Hummer we're actually going to do. So here we have a custom-made vehicle. It's an autonomous vehicle that Carnegie Mellon built that raced across the desert all by itself. And the green part is the space frame we're talking about. So it's a custom military vehicle, and we're talking about making this thing. And figuring out what the easy parts are and what the hard parts are, and so that we're going to make that. Now, again, the question is, what are the people good at, and what is the robot good at? Well, as I mentioned, the robot's really good at positioning parts, and so it's really good kind of an XYZ roll theta yaw positioner. It's also can extend that through augmented reality and tell a person what to do, and it also turns out that it's very good at certain kinds of easy welding. So if you're doing horizontal welding, it can do it in 5 seconds, over and over again, with perfect repeatability, perfect quality. But you know what? The robot can't reach certain places in this complicated structure. So you see Mike over there kind of doing monkey-like exercises to reach certain weld positions. You know what? I can automate that. If I'm willing to hang robots from the ceiling and from the floor and every which way, I can build this multi-million-dollar system and automate most of this. But what's the point of that? This is a custom-made thing. I'm making one or five of these things. Makes no sense. So we're going to try and somehow combine these skills into a system that can do it faster than either. So part of this is we take the CAD design for the custom-made thing, and we automatically extract the data and figure out what the sequence of activities are. But the critical thing here is, each of the steps, the first thing we do is decide whether a person's going to do it or whether a robot's going to do it. I'm not trying to automate everything. I'm trying to make the system, the result, as fast as possible. So in a way, it's a different game than we've been playing for a long time. So the most critical step was this triage between the robot and human. So when we get to the human doing certain activities, we actually automatically construct a tutorial that shows the process. And so this is the kind of a thing a person would see in a large video screen so he could see the context and understand the context. So he sees that first to get an idea of what's going on, so he has a contextual understanding of the process. So the end of the robot's also interesting because we've added a couple of elements. So we have a welding torch, that's the thing that actually connects the stuff together. We have a projector. So a PowerPoint projector like you're seeing now, except for a tiny one that fits almost the size of an iPhone, that's on the end of the robot as well. And now the robot can basically show a PowerPoint on the real world because the projector is calibrated to the actual thing you're doing. So what that means is it can show a person in laser light where to put fixtures, where to put pieces, because remember, it's good at positioning and the person's good at material handling. So it's going to show the person exactly where to put stuff in exactly the right sequence. Now, once you do this, it's really hard to get everything exactly lined up, or the person's actually not as good as 0.03 millimeters. The person's kind of good to 2 millimeters. So we look at where the person put all the stuff with the optical sensor and automatically transform the positions of the robot program so that it's all in the right place. So if the person puts it all off 2 millimeters, then the programs are all automatically adjusted to weld in the right place. So I've actually, with my students, I kind of throw the parts on the thing. So it's actually in real life, I can, you know, plus or minus a foot's okay. And I put a twist on it and make it really nasty. So we had pretty good success if things were plus or minus 15 degrees off, and within a foot of where they were supposed to be, so long as they were connected in the right way. So, and then a person sees projections, again, right size. So the big blue area is exactly where the person's supposed to put the part, and the green just highlights it, and actually they're animated arrows that kind of blink towards that. So the robot basically says, put part 34 at this position. Put this fixture at this position, step by step by step. So we see the various things, the projection on the upper left, the inspection of the redirection, and then finally the robot. If the robot can do it, it can do welds in 5 seconds. If not, then the person does it. So here's a quick video, a person putting a fixture. These are very strong magnets that you can align things. You set the pieces up against each other, step by step. So what's strange about this is the robot's the boss. the robot's telling the person what to do, not the other way around. That's upsetting to a lot of people. So I think that's, in this particular case, that's a great way to go. It actually is like the robot's the master welder and the person's the assistant. Now, at some point, Mike needs to finish it and do all kinds of awkward welding operations that the robot couldn't conveniently do in order for us to complete this. So Mike's doing a lot of the work, but he's been instructed at every step where and what to do. And then the result is the frame on the inside of the Hummer. So how did our competition turn out? Well, the Pratt Miller team had three workers, professional welders. They all paid $75 an hour. Raw materials, the square steel tubes, are $400. And so they charged us 89 billable hours. Actually, they charged us $25,000 when I first got the invoice. And they said, well, usually we just triple the labor. But of course, they've already tripled the value to get to the $75 because no one's getting $75. So actually, they tripled the cost. So we videotaped the whole thing. And so I figured out exactly it was 89 hours because they had videotapes of it all. And then they said, oh, well, that's right. It took 89 hours. We contracted with you to $75. So really, we could only charge you $6,850. So that's one for first advantage. I saved a lot of money for DARPA. So then the second team took Michael, and I have to say, when we first did this, Michael came busting into my office with a smile as big as this room and said, David, I did it. He, in fact, made this space frame in 10 hours. 10 hours. Let's charge him the same rate, $75 an hour, plus the constant cost of the materials, $400. So it cost Michael $1,150 to do the same task. And he was a relative beginner compared to people each with 10 years of experience in welding. And they came and, trust me, they came and looked at his stuff and the robot stuff and was ready to complain about it, and they were very happy about the result. So this is almost 10 times the speed, which translates directly to the bottom line, because it's really all the price here is in the cost, in the time to production, because that's where the hourly rate is. So that means that the government can buy 10 of these for basically the price of one. It's amazing. And it basically means that this kind of technology where the robot's instructing a person, so we get to learn how to manufacture things. We get to learn how to make things along with a robot assistant. So Michael crushed. So what did we learn from this? Robots and people, at least where we are today, really work faster together. The optimal task assignments, meaning the robot's the boss and telling the person what to do, doing certain tasks is surprising. People are better at manipulation. These are really make possible cheaper custom-made products, and we can keep these kinds of activities onshore in the U.S. So that's exciting, too, in terms of jobs. And I think the real bottom line here is how happy Michael was when he came into my office. He was bursting with happiness. And I think, you know, if we set out to do a big job or add on an addition to our house and we can do it ourselves, it's so exciting that we did that ourselves, as long as we're not getting stuck. And so this robot interface basically prevents the stuck phase, which is the thing that makes really making things kind of an unhappy experience. So thank you very much.
Our last speaker on this panel is Professor Tandy Warnow. She is the founder professor of engineering at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Her education, both undergraduate and graduate degrees from the University of California at Berkeley, with a PhD in mathematics. Her research interests focus on computational biology, genomics, and historical linguistics. She's going to come today to talk to us about grand challenges in computational biology, what outstanding algorithms are going to be needed, and how high-performance computing might come to our assistance. Please help me welcome Professor Tandy Warnow.
So it's a pleasure to be here, and the University of Chicago is certainly very different from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, so thank you for having me. So, you know, big data, a lot of us have been talking about big data, and the thing that I'm going to try to get across is that big data, people think that if you have a lot of data, you can answer all the questions you have. You don't even have to be careful about how you analyze it because the signal will be there. And what I'm going to try to convince you of is it's not true. Big data presents new computational challenges and statistical challenges. Big data are typically different from the usual data you have, and to get high accuracy, you need, in fact, new methods. And that the issue here is not running time. The issue here, in fact, that I'm going to address is not running time or space or memory, it's accuracy. How do you actually get high accuracy when you have very large data that's very heterogeneous and typically has lots of errors in it? Okay, so big data, a lot of what we're used to seeing in data now is genomic data, and the amount of genomic data is increasing extremely quickly. And I'm going to zip through this talk just to keep us on time. So this started with the Human Genome Project. You know, we all know about this, but the Human Genome Project was based on computer science theory, graph algorithms with lots of mathematics. It wasn't just, you know, cranking the wheel. We had to do something pretty sophisticated. Those graph algorithms that led to the ability to sequence and assemble whole genomes have been used in many different genome assembly projects, all sorts of really exotic creatures. And it's also now being used, to some extent, to be able to look at metagenomic data, which is basically you take an environmental sample and you actually, it's more than one species, and you want to look at everything that's in that pot of water that you took out of the ocean. How do you do that? This is an additionally complicated challenge because it's not one species you're assembling. You can't apply the usual algorithm. So if you're looking for a nice open problem to work on, this is a really good one. It's been used to understand the human gut and what makes you sick and what makes you healthy. It's also been used to understand how life evolved on Earth, which brings me to my topic, which is how did life evolve on Earth and what are the interesting computer science and statistical questions in this area. So this is basically, you know, apes, the great apes. And what it's showing is human having a sister to us are chimp and bonobo, okay? And then you get to gorilla and finally to orangutan. So how did we figure this out? How do we know, to whatever extent we can know, that this is the true history? We have to go back in time to be sure, but in fact, we cannot go back in time. So what we're doing is we're modeling evolution as a statistical process, and we're using statistical techniques to try to understand that process, which means we need very good techniques and we need very good data, which is why we have this whole genome stuff that we have to work with. So why are we interested in phylogenies? Well, I mean, some of us are just interested because we want to know how did life evolve on Earth. Others of us want to actually use those phylogenies, which are evolutionary trees, to do things like predict the structure and function of different proteins, understand how humans evolved and went across the globe, all sorts of applications, including the flu vaccines that you take every year. Okay, so lots of applications of phylogenies in medicine, lots of applications outside of medicine. Just, you know, there's a saying that Dobzhansky said that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution, and we will just continue to agree with this. Evolution gives you a comparative context to understand many things. Okay, so it's used to understand function, and it's key to many, many, many biological problems. How do we construct them? The way we construct them is that we mathematically model how genomes evolve, and under those mathematical models, we try to infer the history. Now, the problem is almost everything in this area is NP-hard. The computer scientists in the audience will know what NP-hard means, and for everyone else, it simply means don't try to solve it exactly in polynomial time. So these are major grand computational challenges when you get to big data sets, and big means even just 20 can be too large for some of these problems. 5 can be too large for some of these problems. So forget getting up to the thousands and hundreds of thousands. Okay, so cartoon of DNA sequence evolution. Remember human, chimp, gorilla, orangutan? Imagine you're looking at the common ancestor, looking at a little piece of the genome in the common ancestor and tracing the evolution through time. So there's speciation events and the DNA changes. Speciation events and the DNA changes. And it keeps accumulating until you get down to the leaves. And what you're trying to do is, without knowing the history, just reconstruct the tree from what you see at the leaves. That's the statistical inference problem. Okay, so those things are in species that you're getting to look at right now and you want to go back in time. Now, the problem is that that's too simplistic because it's not just substitutions, it's also insertions and deletions. The sequence lengths are changing over time. And that makes the problem even more complicated. So if you have sequences of different lengths and you're trying to get the tree, it's even harder than if they're all the same length. So if you have two sequences, one evolves into the other, that actually defines the true pairwise alignment. And I'm not going to go through this for you, but I'm just going to tell you that if you actually knew how this one sequence evolves into the other, you can say which things should line up on top of each other. That gives you the true pairwise alignment from which you can then extrapolate and get the true multiple sequence alignment. Forgive me for zipping through this, but this is the basic problem. How do you infer a multiple sequence alignment from sequences of different lengths? So how do you get a tree? You have sequences, different lengths. First, you figure out the multiple sequence alignment, and then you construct the tree. You can already see that this is hard because you don't know the truth. So how do we explore performance of methods, right? You can make mathematical theorems, but how do they perform on data? So we have done lots of simulations, and we've looked at this question. So the main thing is that you can do these problems really well if you have small data sets. So there's two dimensions of large. There's the number of species, and then there's the length of the sequences. When both of them are small, lots of methods are good. When either one of them is big, everything is hard. And when both are big, it's completely open. So in the big data deluge, everything is basically up for grabs except everything being small. And mind you, I'm not even going to talk about running time. Okay, so simulations, you have the true tree because you've created it, you've evolved sequences, you know the true alignment, you know the true tree, and now you try to estimate the alignment and you try to estimate the tree and you can compare them against the truth. We did a study, which we published back in 2009, where we said there's lots of ways of doing both steps. Let's look at different ways of estimating multiple sequence alignments, but we're going to keep maximum likelihood as our estimation method. Anyone here knows what maximum likelihood is? Great. It's very fast, relatively speaking. It's an NP-hard problem, so we have heuristics, but they perform well. Here's what we saw. The top is the tree error, and the bottom is the alignment error. There's 15 different model conditions, so as you go from left to right, things get harder. And the top, again, is tree error. The bottom is alignment error. Low is better. The black line is what you get on the true alignment. So just look at the top curve, the top figure. So if you have the true alignment, you go from, on the easy models, you have about 5% error. On the hard models, you have 10% error. 10% means 10% of your tree is wrong. Okay, that's if you have the true alignment. If you have to estimate the alignment, the error is much, much higher. So the impact of alignment error is huge. Okay, alignment error on 1,000 sequences, very hard if the rate of evolution is high. Easy if the rate of evolution is low. Okay, rate of evolution is the issue here. So what about if you don't have a problem with the alignment? Well, here's a polynomial time method which has good statistical guarantees, but as we take bigger and bigger data sets, its error goes up. So the x-axis is the data set size, which is the number of species. The y-axis is the error. Look how that error is exploding. Okay, high error because of the rate of evolution or the amount total of evolution. We're talking about error here, not running time. How do we address the fact that we can't get good alignments and we can't get good trees when we have high rates of evolution? Computer scientists in the audience, the answer is divide and conquer. Okay, I'm going to show you some algorithms with great performance, and some of them have good theorems. Okay, so the major challenge is the current data sets actually are big, and the current methods don't run well on those data sets, and we are going to have even bigger data sets going forward. That's the challenge. So here's an example of a challenge. We published a paper in, I think, November in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy. The first study for plants was not too big, but the next analysis is going to be more than 1,200 sequences that we want to, more than 100,000 sequences that we want to align. 100,000 sequences for alignment. Anyone here knows anything about that? You know it's hard. Okay, so this was in 2005. I said we wanted to be able to get good analyses within a week. We can do it now. It's kind of cool that I had that figure. Start with this one. This was the error of neighbor joining going up as you increase the number of taxa. Guess what? Let's do divide and conquer. Divide the data set into subsets in an automated way, not a heuristic way, an automated, mathematically rigorous way. On those subsets, we apply neighbor joining. We then construct a super tree from the trees. When you divide into subsets, they're overlapping, so you can do this. Here's the error you get when you apply divide and conquer. Flat. So it can't stay flat forever. It's going to have to go up. There's also a nice mathematical theorem that it's because of the amount of data you need. It's only polynomial length sequences instead of exponential. First thing, if we have the true alignment, we can really make a big improvement. But how do we get better alignments? This was the challenge. So for a low rate of evolution over here, we can get good alignments. Higher rate, we get bad alignments. Here's the alignment error down here. Again, low rate of evolution, you get a good alignment. High rate of evolution, you get a bad alignment. Let's do divide and conquer again. Take your initial tree, divide into subsets, get new alignments on the subsets, merge the alignments, repeat. So we're combining iteration. So this iterative process, this is what we got with our first version. This was published in Science in 2009. It's very nice, 24-hour analysis, much better trees, but it's still got a gap. We redesigned it, got even better. So now we have the purple line is much closer to what you get in the true alignment, but that method could only go up to 50,000 sequences. We knew we needed to do more than 100,000 sequences. We redesigned it. We have something that goes up to 1,000,000. This has just been published. We can do multiple sequence alignments and trees at the same time of up to 1,000,000 sequences with extremely high accuracy. So we're having breakthroughs. The point is accuracy. You can't just use high-performance computing and take something that runs on small data sets and expect the accuracy to scale. It does not. You need new ideas. So this is where computer science is contributing, but it gets worse. So this was a single gene. What happens when you take whole genomes? So phylogenomics, the marriage of genomic data plus phylogeny. Different parts of the genome have different trees. You can't just do one part of the genome. And you have to address the heterogeneity. So different parts of the genome, different trees. How are you going to make any sense of this? So we had this avian project that published 8 papers in Science in December. We had 14,000 different genes. Every single one of them was a different tree. And yet we believe that there should be a species tree. So we actually had to develop some mathematical methods to deal with this, and we managed. Okay, so this is the point, the data deluge, 2 different dimensions of large. When they're both large, it's all open for grabs, but we're making progress. It's a really interesting marriage of statistical inference and computation and mathematics. So computer science for big data biology, it's algorithm design, it's statistical inference, it's probabilistic analysis of methods on data, so the data are generated by a stochastic process. You do a lot of simulations, you do a lot of data analysis, and you end up having a lot of fun with impact. So, acknowledgments. This is largely funded by my Guggenheim Fellowship and also various funding and TAC. And TAC is the Texas Advanced Computing Center at the University of Texas. The Avian Project spent 400 CPU years in doing their analysis. The new methods we have can do it much, much faster. So there is a running time advantage, but that's not really the point. The point is accuracy. Thank you.
So we are going to move now into a moderated conversation. Yes, thank you. And thank you. And then we will open the floor for questions. We have crowdsourced questions as well. And so I will be interjecting certain questions from across the globe to our panel that were supplied over the past couple of days, interspersed between the questions that that you have. But I've got a question. At the end of World War II, the philosopher Martin Heidegger wrote an essay called "The Question Concerning Technology." And much of that was dealing with the question of technology and the advent of the nuclear age, and then unfortunately went on to sound a little bit like Bill Clinton trying to define what the meaning of the word is. But if I were to ask you, anyone who's interested in this, what if there is a single question concerning machines, what would you say that question would be? And what do you think the probability of answering that question might be? So So what is the question concerning machines? Do you?
So the question concerning machines, I don't quite get that. But your initial point about Martin Heidegger, I actually know this fairly well. Martin was very big on saying it's not, you know, bad, there's no such thing as bad technology, there's only bad people. And so he was where that started from. And so there's certainly huge potential, we discussed this earlier, about robots and even computers causing problems in our society. So this is something we're going to have to actively understand and manage, and I think my talk represented that as well, because I'm trying to, even if there's a way to make things totally automatically, I'm trying to avoid that in a sense, because I want to insert people so that we stay up on what's going on, so we stay involved in it, and yet make it an enjoyable process, because really we're trying to make machines for us, not just for, you know, so we can all go home to watch soap operas. So I don't know if that answered your question, but...
Well, is there some fundamental question that you think is the question that keeps you up at night, et cetera? Yes.
So I want to just talk about something that I'm always concerned about, which is everyone uses software and assumes that the answers are as intended. There's a whole field of, you know, basically proving that your programs are correct or software verification, but what I would say is that it's a basic problem. When you apply a method and you assume it's correctly calculating something, you're probably wrong. And so to the extent that this is an issue, how are we addressing this as scientists? How are we addressing this as software developers? How are we addressing this in terms of even using the output we get from a method and being able to know how much we can rely upon and how much we cannot rely upon? And this is not just the issue of NP-hard problems and getting a quote-unquote solution to an NP-hard problem and thinking it's the correct solution. It's actually worse than that. So the basic question of reliability, and software reliability is a much bigger, harder problem than I can cope with.
I don't know that anything particularly keeps me up at night, but I would say certainly from my perspective, the biggest issue with machines is actually just this issue of control. So we have very capable machines that are actually very capable mechanically, and the question is how to control them not only in a way that's very functional, but also that's going to be adaptable and changing over time as we want the machine to be interacting with us or with their environment and their task over time. And this is we certainly see this within assistive domains. So we have prosthetic arms, for example, that are much more complex than we're actually able to control with the signals we can get from the human. But I don't think this is limited to just the signals coming from the human in general. So this issue of control is really, really crucial. And I think we're going to see it evolve from traditionally, it has been more about with a machine specifically. It's been more about controlling your position and velocity. So it's very concretely anchored to what we expect the machine to be visibly doing. But control also gets abstracted to higher levels, and we're going to see that more and more as we're able to port more sophisticated AI algorithms to actual physical machines, which doesn't really happen yet. Within robotics, AI pretty much just looks like search. Sophisticated, like cognitive systems, don't exist on real hardware yet. And by that, I mean hardware taking physical action in the world.
Okay.
Up at night, maybe not thinking necessarily about machines, but about the software that's deployed on them. Mm-hmm. Software has the ability to dictate how we communicate with people and how we interact with other people. And it can follow then that the people who write the software are making the rules for our kind of social interactions with other people, and I think that's an incredible responsibility, and I think that not many engineers understand that responsibility is part and parcel with their role as scientists or of developers. So I can write a very performant algorithm, and actually I prefer to do that. That's kind of what I do all day. But it's not my algorithms that are really having the impact on people. It's how the algorithms play into a larger product that is kind of dictating how people can spend their time, spend their resources, interact with other people. So that's what keeps me up at night. I think there's a great deal of responsibility that comes with software engineering, and I don't think that many people take it to heart.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to open up the talk now to any questions that you might have to one another. Is there anything that was said that piqued your interest or that you would wish to challenge or are curious about?
Okay, so we have two questions.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
So you showed this basically cost advantage of having the robot-assisted competition, or rather analysis, construction. Did you have any evaluation of the quality of the object after it was computed and constructed, and which one, if so, which one was better?
So, yes, we did. In fact, the Pratt Miller team was the one who taught Michael how to weld in the first place, and so they were very anxious to come and see their students' results. So, first of all, they gave the thumbs up to Michael as a learning welding person. The robot welding, if the robot's assigned to something, it's usually a simpler thing, and everyone's willing to say that the robot's better at it. Because controlling when you weld something, you basically melt metal, and there's like a pool of liquid that's kind of moving around, and you know, if it's vertical, then the liquid's kind of falling under gravity, and so that's very hard to do. So a robot, if it's is actually really good at some of this stuff, and so if the robot was asked to do it, then it was designed, it was chosen to be the easier thing that the robot was good at, and Michael got given the thumbs up for the rest. So the quality was very high, actually.
I actually have a follow-up question about the cost analysis.
Sure.
What I think was missing from your chart was the cost of the robot. Even if it's not that you need to buy the hardware one-off, you might have to like program it for that task or something along those lines. So do you have thoughts about that or an intuition on that?
Yeah, so first of all, the hardware, the fixtures, et cetera, used by the Pratt and Miller team with people only was basically twice as expensive as the robot. The robot cost $40,000 and their stuff cost $100,000. They used all kinds of graphics to basically they would print ahead of time so they could lay it out. So they were kind of doing the augmented reality thing, but on paper. And then their fixtures were very expensive because they were part of the, you know, making the racing cars for NASCAR. So it was at least $100,000 worth of equipment. So virtually twice as expensive. But again, you know, there's kind of a cost of the equipment and then kind of the repeated cost after that. So in both cases, I didn't really count that because I was kind of carrying it forward from the initial equipment cost.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to open the microphone now for any questions from the audience.
I have a question, too.
Oh, yes, please. I'm sorry.
Well, somebody should line up. But anyway, I wanted to ask Tandy. That's your name, right? Tandy. Google's big thing these days is something called deep learning. I'm sure you're familiar with that. But it's basically Google has an amazing amount of data for everything. And it's all heterogeneous. So if you look at, if you do a Google search on giraffe, they give you every kind of conceivable variation of a baby giraffe, a big giraffe, a stuffed toy giraffe, in every combination. And from that, they're able to get a very good categorization of the concept of giraffe, which is something AI people have struggled with for 50 years or 60 years. Has anyone tried that in your field, for one thing, deep learning, or you think it's nonsense?
Deep learning is very interesting. It's not applicable for this particular problem because this is, you're not trying to learn a concept, you're trying to learn the specific parameters of the thing that generates your data, which is a very different kind of thing. On the other hand, it could be used in a different way. So evolution isn't necessarily tree-like, and there's horizontal gene transfer, and there's all sorts of things, hybridization that go on, and so it could be used in a different context towards something more complicated, like trying to be able to detect when you have these, what are called reticulate evolutions. But for the thing that I'm talking about, the deep learning thing isn't applicable.
Okay.
All right, thank you. And remember, please state your name and your association.
All right, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Sam, and I'm a student from the college. Thank you, speakers, for your very enriching presentations. My question is for Professor Born. What do you think are the skills necessary for the typical manufacturing worker to thrive in this new future of manufacturing that you've just painted for us? And do you think it's necessary for education to change to reflect these new developments and better prepare the workforce of the future for those things?
This is a really good question that's in front of our society in general. I think it's absolutely necessary that everyone is computer literate to some level. So intrinsically here is running a computer in the background. You have to start it up and, you know, run through the PowerPoint and feel comfortable about that. So being really kind of fluent and easy with computers is essential for, I think, everyone in our society, at really every level, more and more. Now, something I did say, but maybe I didn't emphasize enough, is that Michael still, the graduate student, is one of these hands-on people. So, you know, there's probably some of us that never could have done this, is the truth. So I started with somebody who was intrinsically good at making things. Didn't know how to weld, and so I didn't tell him his truth about that. But he's somebody that had an aesthetic for what's a good thing to make and how it should look, and some of that's difficult to teach. So there's still going to be those are good at this kind of thing and those are not so good at this kind of thing. That's for sure. But coming back to the education, there's I think there's some understanding of geometry, but you know, we're going to see some people, there's going to be a stratification in the workforce still. And so if you're making electronic things or if you're making space frames for Hummers, then you're probably going to need a subtly different kind of education. So, you know, if you can do testing of electronics or something, that might be something that a person would still have to do and have some understanding of that. So, again, depending on the industry and the domain, there's going to be some specialization so involved in education. So we're going to see a lot of the same things, but at the bottom of it is computer fluency.
Hi, my name is Neural, a visitor to the university. I'm a project manager by background. Question for Laura. We've had principles and concepts like modular and object-oriented for a long time. What is it about either the evolution of technology or the state of the practice that made containerization what it is right now and at this time?
Thanks. Good question. I want to make a distinction between problems that are solved using different types of data structures and then problems that are solved using different system processes, because they're kind of two different spheres of computer science. So the containerization as a level of or layer of virtualization is happening in the process systems area, and things like object orientation or other algorithm and efficiency problems are happening in the data structures area. Certainly they're connected to each other, but there is kind of two different ways two avenues, I guess, to approach the same problem. I think containerization has become popular because it kind of, when you think about it, it sort of takes away some of the bulkiness and some of the work that had been done previously, and we're kind of distilling things back to kind of just a base kernel that can be shared instead of dumping a bunch of stuff on top of it, which is attractive for many reasons, just for its simplicity, but then also because of the lack of overhead, reducing costs and time and frustration, to be honest, from an engineering perspective. So,
we have a question from Beijing. This is actually addressed to Professors Argall and Born. As machines become smarter and smarter and smarter, should we not be concerned with giving them too much physical ability? And the answer, of course, can be no.
Yes. I actually think that question, if we're going to think about regulating, it actually boils back down to the issue of control. I think actually the machine being very physically capable, if it's controlled in the right way, and this also gets at what was spoken about earlier, if it's controlled in the right way, then it should only ever be a benefit that it's more capable physically. Whether or not, and same to the quote about, you know, there's no bad machines, there's just bad humans. And I think that's actually really, really the issue. And I don't see it as an advantage to sort of limit ourselves in the capabilities of the machines we create, how that's actually going to address the problem, because there's still going to be opportunities to do bad things with machines that are actually just unstable and unpredictable and less capable.
Mm-hmm. So I want to bring up a slightly new subject that answers this question related to autonomous vehicles. Mm-hmm. So we're on the dawn of a new age, really, where none of us are going to drive anymore. That's not going to happen in 30 years. That's going to happen, you know, companies are starting to do this now. And in 5 years, I think it's going to be, if I have a bet with the past director of the Robotics Institute, $100 bet, that in 10 years I'll be able to take a robotic vehicle like Uber from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia and run up the stairs where Rocky ran up and celebrate. So I have a $100 bet that in 2025 is coming due, and I believe that strongly is going to happen. Now, the benefits of having robotic vehicles is unbelievable. So anybody who drives often looks into your neighbor's vehicle and watches them eat sandwiches and texting and talking on their cell phone, putting on makeup and three or four other things all at the same time. And the result of this is 1.3 million deaths a year. I strongly believe that almost overnight that number is going to be cut by 90%. Now, there's still odd cases that come up, and you know, there's examples like in front of you a lady crosses the road with her baby carriage. Now, you have a choice of running over the lady with the baby carriage or swerving into oncoming traffic. Those are your two choices. Now, a robot may not be able to do that so well, or even if it is able to make a rational decision, quote unquote, it's going to run over the baby or run into traffic, either one. And that's going to make huge news, and there's going to be huge carnage as a result. So it's not going to go away. There's kind of intrinsic into this whole process these conundrums. But there's that million people we're going to save at the first part by having these machines that are focused on driving or experts at driving. Example of why, if you don't believe me, I drive through the country all the time and deer jump out at me. And so I slam on the brakes and cars behind me don't know what I'm doing. So it's perfectly, the first thing we're going to have is basically all these vehicles are sharing information with each other. If I slam on the brake, the car behind me and the car behind it, et cetera, knows this is going to happen. And so everyone's going to be able to come to a stop. Even if I hit the deer, there's not going to be that chain reaction that's so common, so expensive, so costly to lives and property. So I agree with you. That was a very long answer.
Okay, thank you. So my name is Severin Taylor, student at U Chicago. A first remark beforehand about driving cars, right? It's not as simple as that, right? First of all, a car is not, I mean, first of all, we have so many different kinds of roads. There is no standard form of a road, right? So we would have to standardize our roads, because how would a car be able, I doubt that a car is able to detect roads equally well in a city than on some faraway, in a desert, right? Or some faraway place, right? Whereas there's not as good of an infrastructure. So if a requirement for driverless cars is, first of all, having standardized streets, so that the objects will be easily detectable. Then, so my question is this. This was just a remark about driverless cars. My question is the following. As we do more and more automation, we'll be able to produce more and more. But at the same time, we're going to have fewer human workers. And what that slide didn't show you is that the workers that's left is not going to earn $75, right, anymore. So what I'm saying is that, isn't it absurd? We're producing more and more, but we're hiring fewer and fewer people, and they're not going to be, they won't be able to act as consumers anymore, or in a restricted way. So who's going to buy these products, right?
There are two questions there, I think, or two comments. So it's been the tradition of robotics anyway, is that as we make progress and we put more and more automation, that basically the employment rate has stayed flat. The robots have basically there's been no attribution whatsoever to lost jobs in robotics. That's an historical comment. As we move forward, I guess you could say that it's necessarily the case as, you know, basically you automate everything. But that comes back to my point that I think people and robots should work together. Because what we're doing is going into a new world. We're not just making automobiles that are black anymore. We're trying to make customized things that you want to buy for you without a middleman, and so that's a new paradigm. And so everybody wants certain things, certain individualistic life. And so this opens up that possibility, that creative possibility that's never really been possible for humankind before, unless you're living out in the tundra. But they do that for need. So that's my comment. So I think the world's changing, where the product requirements are going to change in a radical way. So we're going to see small manufacturing sites scattered all over, making custom cars, you know, three blocks from here. They're not going to be shipped from China or shipped from Japan anymore. So that's a different worldview, and there's plenty of room in there for people. That's the second question. The first question is, you know, actually robots are pretty good at detecting objects. So you had mentioned about lasers, so we basically can put a laser umbrella over a robot and measure very accurately, can reconstruct three-dimensionally everything that's around a robot. Now, it has limited visibility just like we do. But actually, the robot knows much better within like a 12-foot window than we ever would. All, you know, 360 degrees and over the top. So 10 or 15 years ago, we drove across the country large, 99.2% totally by robot on various kinds of roads. So it's not, you don't necessarily need new structures in the road, you know, magnetic strips. This is all sensor-based. It really starts with GPS. So you get kind of a map. You have maps of where you're going just like you do. So the robot's following the same kind of instructions, using the sensors to make modifications as it goes. So kind of the sliding autonomy between that and GPS.
Yeah, I guess I would just add on to that I've never heard within the robotics or autonomous vehicles community any suggestion that the infrastructure of roads would need to be changed to accommodate the robots. I could perhaps see that there are certain roads that would just be inaccessible before the technology is fully matured, but this isn't that different than, you know, there are certain roads that you need to take a four-wheel drive vehicle on. And so I certainly could see that happening. I haven't heard people talk about that. The infrastructure that I could see possibly changing is that we start to have information being disseminated along major throughways like highways. That is, for example, talking directly to the cars about the fact that there's an accident up ahead, something like that. But that's really more of like a sensor-based information dissemination technology. I think that the community, the autonomous driving community, definitely thinks that the robots should be able to handle the roads as they are now. And they already can handle a large portion of them.
Okay, please join me in thanking our panel.